So imagine you're this like ultra high net worth investor,
Oh,
right?
nice. Living the dream.
Exactly. And you have just wired $5 million in, cold, hard, cleared cash to a major brokerage firm.
Just a casual Tuesday.
Right. And you've hand signed this stack of legal documents that's like honestly thicker than a phone book.
Assuming people remember what phone books look like, yeah.
Fair point. But you've got the champagne chilling because in your mind, you just bought into the most exclusive private equity deal of the decade.
Makes sense. You did the paperwork, you sent the money.
Right, so you own the asset, right?
Well,
Wrong. Legally speaking, your broker cannot do a single thing with your money yet.
yeah, their hands are completely tied.
They can't process the trade, they can't book their commission. In the eyes of the regulators, until one specific thing happens, that $5 million is basically just sitting in purgatory.
Regulatory purgatory, the worst kind.
Totally. And today, we are going to find out exactly why that is. And more importantly, how you listening right now can use this knowledge to just absolutely dominate the Series 82 exam.
That is the goal.
But real quick, first, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 82 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and these unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
It's honestly the ultimate tool for this kind of dense material.
It really is. You can check it out at certfuel.com. So let's get right into it. You are prepping for the Series 82, specifically Function 4, which is processing and confirming transactions.
A very heavy section.
Yeah. And if you have ADHD like I do, or if you just, generally despise dry textbook style lectures, staring at a wall of thin raw text is a one-way ticket to zoning out completely.
Oh, absolutely. It's just
Yeah.
this massive wall of thou shalts and thou shalt nots.
Right. And we aren't doing that today.
No, we absolutely cannot do that. I mean, to actually retain this information, to recall it under that intense pressure of the exam clock,
Yeah.
we have to step out of the abstract rule book.
We have to get into the real world.
Exactly. You need to understand the underlying architecture.
Yeah.
Like, why did the SEC and FINRA even write these rules in the first place?
What disasters were they trying to stop, or?
Spot on. Because if you understand the why, the what just becomes second nature.
I love that approach.
Yeah.
Like, the friction is the feature. So to make this stick for you guys listening, we are building a cinematic universe today.
Oh, I'm ready for this.
We are going to follow one massive, super complicated private placement transaction from the initial handshake all the way to like a bitter corporate breakup years later.
Drama. I love it.
Right. And to do that, we need a cast of characters. If you can track what happens to these three people, you will crush this section.
Let's introduce them. Who's up first?
So first we have Riley the rep. Riley is a registered representative at a mid-sized broker-dealer.
Okay, Riley the rep.
He's eager. He's aggressive. He's working the phones like 12 hours a day building his book of business.
And let me guess, his primary motivation is just closing the deal.
Oh, 100%. He wants to get the trade processed, earn his massive commission, and go buy a boat.
A classic Riley. I've met 100 Rileys.
We all have. Next, we have Ingrid the investor. Ingrid is a highly accredited, super high net worth individual.
Nice. Where'd her money come from?
Let's say she sold a tech startup a few years ago. So she has tens of millions in liquid cash.
Wow. Okay, Ingrid.
But she is incredibly impatient. She's used to getting her way instantly. She basically treats her million-dollar investments like Amazon Prime.
She wants one-click purchasing and immediate delivery.
Exactly. And finally, pulling all the strings behind the curtain, we have Sam, the sponsor.
Ah, Sam, the issuer.
Right. He's the CEO of a private real estate development firm. He's sitting in this mahogany-lined office downtown, managing the actual private placement offering.
So maybe he's trying to raise, what, $50 million to buy a commercial skyscraper?
Perfect, yes. Sam controls the product. He doesn't work for Riley's broker-dealer. He is the creator of the security that's actually being sold.
Got it. Okay, the board is set. We've got Riley, Ingrid, and Sam.
So let us jump right into the narrative. Ingrid loves Sam's new commercial real estate deal. She is all in.
He's ready to buy.
Yep. She reads the private placement memorandum. She signs the massive 50-page subscription agreement, and she immediately wires $500,000 to Riley's broker-dealer firm.
Okay, big money moving.
And Riley is just vibrating with excitement. He has the signed paper from Ingrid. He sees the $500,000 sitting in his firm's clearing account.
He's already picking out the color of his boat.
Exactly. So he sprints to his compliance manager's office and says, "Process this trade right now."
Okay, stop right there.
Yeah, speaking directly to you, the listener, right now, put yourself in that compliance manager's shoes.
You've got the client signature.
You have cleared fence. So, can Riley's firm process this purchase?
Take a beat. Think about it.
Just really think.
Okay.
The answer is absolutely not.
No way. It's actually one of the most fundamental misunderstandings of the private placement process.
Right, because at this exact moment, the broker-dealer firm has zero authority to process anything.
None. Because processing a private placement starts with a document that the broker-dealer doesn't even control.
Sam, the sponsor, the issuer, has to act first.
Exactly. Riley's firm cannot process this purchase until Sam formally accepts Ingrid's subscription agreement.
And he usually does that by, like, physically or digitally countersigning the document.
Right. It feels incredibly counterintuitive from a retail perspective.
Totally. I mean, if I go to Best Buy with cash and I want to buy a TV, the store doesn't have to call Samsung to get permission to ring me up.
No, they just take your money. But private placements aren't TVs.
Here's the weird, kind of absurd mechanical analogy that makes this click for me. Think of it like walking into an exclusive high-end tattoo parlor.
Okay, a tattoo parlor. I'm with you.
You want this massive custom back piece. You sign all their liability waivers. You slap 5 grand in cash on the counter. You are sitting in the chair, ready to go.
But the actual artist hasn't agreed to do your specific design yet.
Right. Maybe they hate the art style, or their schedule's booked up for the next 2 years. Even though you brought the cash and signed the waiver, the front desk cannot ring up the sale.
Because they can't process the transaction until the artist physically looks at it and says, "Yes, I accept this client."
Exactly. Is that how it works legally with Sam?
It is a perfect analogy because it highlights exactly where the liability lies. Riley's broker-dealer is just a chaperone.
Here's making the introduction.
Right. The actual binding legal contract is being formed directly between Ingrid the investor and Sam the sponsor.
So Sam has his own regulatory stuff to worry about.
Oh, plenty of it. He has fiduciary duties. He needs to review Ingrid's paperwork. He has to verify her accredited investor status.
Make sure she's actually as rich as she claims.
Exactly. And he needs to ensure that accepting her $500,000 won't cause his offering to exceed its legal maximum limit and become oversubscribed.
Wow. Okay. So until Sam confirms all of that and basically binds his company to the deal via that countersignature, there is literally no trade.
No trade at all. And if I were writing the exam, I would be drooling over this concept because it is so easy to trick a candidate.
Oh, yeah. They love to set traps here. Listeners, pay attention.
They will paint this beautiful, complete picture in the question stem. They'll write, "The customer has signed the subscription agreement in full, all suitability checks have been passed, and the account is funded with cleared cash."
And your brain automatically wants to complete the circuit and say, awesome, process it.
But you have to train your brain to stop and look for Sam's signature. No issuer acceptance equals no processing.
Let's make that a mantra. No issuer signature, no processing.
All right.
Okay, so let's advance the timeline. Let's say a week goes by.
Poor Ingrid is probably furious about the wait.
Oh, she's definitely yelling at Riley on the phone. But Sam, the sponsor, finally reviews her file. He loves it. He countersigns the sub-agreement, and he securely transmits it back to Riley's firm.
The tattoo artist said yes.
The gates are open. So at that exact moment, the broker-dealer's internal machinery kicks into gear, right?
It does. Alongside that newly accepted subscription agreement, Riley's firm is now legally required to generate three highly specific internal processing documents.
Okay, here comes the paperwork avalanche. What are the three specific documents? I want to make sure I get these down.
First, and arguably most importantly, is the blotter entry.
The blotter.
Yes, the blotter is the official chronological diary of the firm. It records the transaction happening in real time.
Okay, so that's one.
Second, you need the principal's review and approval.
Right, so like a manager's signature.
Exactly. It's a registered manager's formal, documented blessing on the transaction. It proves supervisory oversight.
Got it. And the third.
Third, they must generate payment or wire instructions. This dictates exactly how, when, and where Ingrid's funds are going to actually move to settle the trade.
Okay, so blotter, principal approval, wire instructions. That makes logical sense. But I'm noticing a pretty glaring omission here.
What's missing?
Well, if I call up my normal broker right now and say, hey, buy me 100 shares of Apple at the market price, the very first thing that broker does is write up an order ticket, right? Officially an order memorandum.
Right, a standard trade ticket.
So why isn't the order ticket on your list of mandatory internal documents for this private placement?
That omission leads us to a very specific, very narrow, and highly tested exception in the FINRA record-keeping rules. We are dealing with a transaction made on a subscription way basis.
Okay, let's define that subscription way basis. What does that actually mean?
It means the customer is purchasing the security directly from the issuer, like our private placement scenario, rather than buying it from another investor on the secondary market. And when a trade is conducted on a subscription way basis, the SEC and FINRA rules state that the standard order memorandum does not have to be generated.
Wait, really? The regulators, who are basically obsessed with paperwork and documenting every time a broker sneezes, just say, eh, don't worry about the order ticket for this multi-million dollar deal.
I know, it sounds
That
crazy.
seems like a massive loophole. What's stopping a shady broker from just executing a bunch of unrecorded off-the-books trades?
It would totally be a loophole, except it is a highly conditional exemption. The firm is only excused from creating that internal order ticket if they maintain a very specific substitute document in its place.
Okay. The substitution. They aren't letting you off the hook.
Exactly. They're just acknowledging that creating an internal order ticket is redundant if you already have a legally binding contract that contains all the exact same information.
That makes sense. So, what is the substitute document?
It depends on the direction of the trade. If it's a purchase like Ingrid buying into Sam's fund, the firm must keep a copy of the customer's fully executed subscription agreement as the substitute for the order ticket.
So, the sub-agreement steps in for the order ticket.
Right. Now, if down the line Ingrid were doing a sale or a redemption of those shares, the substitute document would be a copy of whatever specific redemption document the issuer requires.
Okay, I want to play devil's advocate here for a second, because this is exactly where my ADHD brain gets things twisted when I'm rushing through a multiple choice test.
Bring it on.
Listen to my logic here and tell me why I'm about to fail this question.
Okay.
If the rules say we don't need an order ticket because it's a subscription way trade, and an order ticket is basically just a record of the trade happening,
Yeah.
then we shouldn't need a blotter entry either, right?
Oh, I see where you're going.
Right, because they're basically recording the same event. Why do you double the work? If the sub-agreement replaces the ticket, shouldn't it replace the blotter too?
And that line of thinking right there is exactly what the test writers are praying you do.
Oh no. So I failed.
You failed that question. You have to actively separate those two documents in your mind because they serve entirely different regulatory functions.
Okay, break it down for me. Direct comparison.
Think of the order ticket like a sticky note that a broker writes for one specific isolated task. It just says, buy this for this guy at this price.
Okay, a sticky note.
Right. And the regulators say, okay, you don't need the sticky note because you have the 50-page subscription agreement that says the exact same thing and it has the client's signature.
Okay, so the sticky note is gone, tossed in the trash, replaced by the contract.
Right. But the blotter is not a sticky note. The blotter is the firm's master ledger. It is a permanent, chronological, unalterable diary of every single penny and every single share that moves into or out of that brokerage firm on any given day.
Oh, wow. So it's like the master timeline.
Exactly. When FINRA auditors walk into a firm, the very first thing they ask for is the blotter because it lets them reconstruct the firm's entire day.
So you can't just skip it.
Never. The subscription way exception never reaches the blotter. The blotter entry remains strictly required 100% of the time, regardless of how the transaction was made.
Direct question to you listening. If a question asks which record-keeping requirement is waived for a subscription away private placement, and blotter is one of the options, do you click it?
You never click it.
Never click it. The exception applies only to the order ticket. The blotter is sacred.
Exactly. The blotter is the heartbeat of the firm's books. You cannot turn the heartbeat off just because you have a fancy subscription agreement.
All right, pattern interrupt. Tap the steering wheel, take a sip of coffee, shake it out.
We are moving fast here.
We are. So we have the paperwork signed. Sam accepted it. Riley got his principal's approval. He made his sacred blotter entry and he mapped out the wire instructions.
Machinery is humming.
Right. But now Riley is physically holding this incredibly important, fully executed subscription agreement. He has to file it away for regulatory retention. Which brings us to a massive structural mystery in the rule book.
It really is a mystery. If you just try to read the index of the FINRA rule book and scour the retention schedules looking for the specific phrase subscription agreement, you will come up empty.
Wait, really? There's no specific rule for it.
There is no isolated, dedicated retention rule drafted exclusively for a subscription agreement.
Which is wild. I mean, they have rules detailing exactly how long you have to keep, like, a complaining email from a disgruntled client, but they don't have a standalone rule for the primary legal contract of a $50 million deal.
It seems like an oversight, but it's not.
So how on earth is a compliance officer supposed to know how long to keep the thing?
You have to deduce it logically by looking at the mechanical function the document is performing. Remember the exception we just spent the last 10 minutes talking about?
The substitution rule. The subagreement takes the place of the order ticket.
Exactly. Because the records rule excuses the order ticket only if the firm keeps the subscription agreement copy in its place. The subscription agreement essentially inherits the order memorandum's retention rules.
Oh, that's clever.
It steps into its shoes. It rides in the order ticket's bucket.
I love that visual. It's like an understudy taking over the lead role on Broadway. The understudy doesn't get a brand new dressing room built just for them. They just take over the lead actor's dressing room.
That's a great way to look at it. And because it lands in the order memorandum's dressing room, it falls under the standard retention period for most routine transaction records.
Which is how long?
The broker-dealer must keep it for a period of not less than 3 years. Furthermore, for the first 2 years of that three-year period, it must be kept in an easily accessible place.
Okay, let's drill down into easily accessible. In the age of cloud computing, what does that actually mean physically? Does it mean it can't be locked in a filing cabinet in a disused lavatory in a basement?
Well, before digital records, it literally meant exactly that. You couldn't box the paper up and ship it to some deep storage warehouse in Nevada where it takes 3 weeks to retrieve a single pallet.
Right.
Easily accessible means that if an examiner walks into your branch unannounced on a Tuesday morning and demands the records from Ingrid's trade, you can produce them promptly, usually that same day.
And today?
Today, with worm-compliant digital storage, that's write once, read many, it means having immediate terminal access to pull those files without waiting for some massive archival decryption.
Okay, so 3 years total, the first 2 years immediately accessible. Got it.
Right.
But all right, I am looking at this from the perspective of a highly stressed candidate sitting in the Prometric Testing Center. The clock is ticking down. I get a question that says, under which retention category is a private placement subscription agreement held?
A classic question.
And I look at the multiple choice options.
Mm.
And one of the options is written agreements.
Ah, yes. The trap.
My brain immediately says, a subscription agreement is a contract. A contract is a written agreement. Therefore, it must go in the written agreements bucket. It seems so incredibly obvious. Why is that the wrong answer?
It is the most seductive wrong answer on the whole exam. It feels so logically sound, but it ignores the fundamental legal relationships at play. We have to go back to the why.
Okay, why?
The written agreements retention category in the regulatory rulebook is strictly, exclusively reserved for agreements that the broker-dealer firm itself enters into as a legally bound party.
Oh, give me an example of what would go in that bucket then.
Sure. A margin agreement signed between the broker-dealer and a retail client. An employment contract between the broker-dealer and Riley. A clearing agreement between the broker-dealer and a massive clearing firm.
Okay, so in all those cases, the broker-dealer is one of the names actually signing on the dotted line.
Yes, they have direct rights and obligations under that specific contract.
Right, and in our scenario with Ingrid and Sam,
Riley's firm is just the broker. They are the matchmaker. The subscription agreement is a binding contract strictly between Ingrid the investor and Sam the sponsor.
The broker-dealer isn't a party to it at all.
Exactly. If Sam breaches the contract, Ingrid sues Sam, not Riley's firm. Because the broker-dealer is not a party to it, it legally cannot fall under the firm's own written agreements record-keeping category.
Even though the three-year timeline happens to be exactly the same for both categories, the rationale is totally different.
Exactly. If the exam asks you to trace the lineage of why or how it's retained, you must trace it back to the order memorandum category, never the written agreements category.
It's standing in for the sticky note.
Exactly. Not because it's a contract the firm signed.
That is the exact kind of nuance that separates a passing score from a failing score. The firm didn't sign it, so it's not their agreement. Boom. Done.
Done.
Let's shift gears completely. We have all the paper sorted, it's signed, it's filed away for 3 years. But paper doesn't build a commercial skyscraper. Paper doesn't pay the bills.
We need the cash.
Where is Ingrid's actual $500,000 right now? It can't just be floating in the ether. How does a private placement actually settle?
That is the $1 million question, or $500,000 in this case.
Right. Like, if I buy shares of Microsoft on a Tuesday, I know exactly when that money leaves my account and the shares hit my portfolio because of standard clearing rules. Does Sam, the sponsor, just use the regular clearinghouse system?
No, and this is a vital reality check for anyone moving from the retail side of the exam to the private placement side. Private placements do not use a clearing corporation's regular way settlement cycle.
Let's contrast them so the mechanism is clear. How does regular way actually work?
Think of regular way clearing for publicly traded stocks, like a city's municipal water system.
Okay.
It is a massive, centralized, highly automated piece of third-party utility infrastructure. Millions of trades go into the National Securities Clearing Corporation, the NSCC. They net everything out, and the trades settle on a fixed, automated, unbreakable timetable.
Which is what right now, T plus one?
Currently, yes, T plus one. Trade date plus one business day. It just happens automatically in the background.
Right. I turn on the tap, the water flows.
Right.
I don't have to negotiate with the local reservoir.
Exactly. But a private placement is not hooked up to the municipal water supply. A private placement is like ordering a bespoke water delivery truck to drive out to a remote, off-the-grid cabin.
I love that. Totally off the grid.
It is entirely manual, entirely customized, and the rules of delivery are written from scratch for every single deal.
So who acts as the traffic cop? Who decides when the money finally changes hands and the shares are officially minted in Ingrid's name?
The offering documents dictate everything.
The paperwork rules all.
The subscription agreement that Ingrid signed and the private placement memorandum, the PPM that accompanied it, they said the exact specific terms for payment and for closing.
They are the absolute law of the land for that specific deal.
Yes. If the PPM says the deal settles on the third Tuesday of next month, pending an environmental review of the real estate, then that is when it settles.
Direct question to the listener. If an exam question presents a complex private placement scenario and asks, on what date does this transaction settle?
Mm-hmm.
And you see T plus one or T plus two in the multiple choice options, do you select them?
Never.
Absolutely not. Never apply standard exchange traded settlement cycles to a private placement. The answer is always some variation of according to the terms set forth in the offering documents.
Correct. Now, let's talk about the physical custody of that cash while we wait for that bespoke settlement date.
Where does it sit?
The SEC's payment handling rule governs exactly how a broker-dealer must handle the sale price in any distribution other than a standard firm commitment underwriting. And the path Ingrid's money takes depends entirely on the presence of one single word.
One word to rule them all. What is it?
Contingency.
Contingency. Okay.
Is the private placement offering contingent or is it non-contingent?
Let's explore path one first.
Yep.
Non-contingent. We can call this the straight shot. What does a non-contingent deal actually look like in practice?
A non-contingent deal means the private placement is happening no matter what. Let's say Sam, the sponsor, is just raising money for a general corporate operating fund.
Okay, so just cash for the business.
Right. He would love to raise $50 million, but if he only raises $5 million, he's still going to take the $5 million and use it to hire some staff and lease an office. There is no minimum threshold that must be met to trigger the deal.
The deal is on from day one.
Exactly.
Okay, so in that scenario, Ingrid wires her $500,000 to Riley's firm. What does Riley's firm do with the cash?
In a non-contingent offering, the broker-dealer firm is legally required to promptly transmit the money directly to the persons entitled to it, which in this case is Sam, the sponsor.
So they just pass it right through?
Yep. The firm receives the funds, processes the internal paperwork, and sends the cash straight through to the issuer. They do not hold on to it.
Simple enough. But path two is where the regulatory friction really heats up, right? The contingent deal, the waiting game. Give me the mechanics of a contingent offering.
Okay, let's change Sam's business plan. Sam is no longer raising a general operating fund. Sam has signed a contract to purchase a very specific commercial skyscraper, and the purchase price is exactly $50 million.
The whole 50.
Right. He is running an all-or-none contingent offering. He tells his investors, I need to raise exactly $50 million. If I only raise $49.9 million, I cannot buy the building. If I can't buy the building, the investment thesis is void and the whole deal is off.
Or there's the mini-max variation too, right? Where he says, I need a minimum of $20 million to buy the base property, but I'll accept up to $50 million to fund renovations.
Exactly. Both are contingent offerings because a specific threshold, the contingency, must be crossed before the deal becomes real.
So in this all-or-none scenario, Ingrid is the very first investor. She wires her $500,000 to Riley's firm on day one. Sam still needs to find $49.5 million from a bunch of other investors.
It can take a while.
Can Riley's firm just promptly transmit Ingrid's money to Sam like they did in path one?
Absolutely, unequivocally no.
Because what if he spends it?
Exactly. If they give Sam the money now, and 3 months later the offering fails because Sam couldn't find any other investors, what happens? Sam might have already spent Ingrid's money on marketing brochures, legal fees, or, you know, executive bonuses.
And the money's gone. The building isn't purchased, and Ingrid is suing Riley's firm into oblivion for failing to protect her assets.
Precisely. So the broker-dealer has to act as a dam holding the water back.
But they can't just stick a $500,000 check in Riley's desk drawer, and they definitely can't just dump it into the broker-dealer's own corporate checking account. That would be commingling, which is a massive violation.
Huge violation. You lose your license for that.
So where exactly must they hold it?
The SEC rules are incredibly strict here. The broker-dealer must use one of two specific holding methods. And I want to stress this because candidates often get confused.
Right.
Neither method outranks the other. They are equally valid compliance paths.
Okay, let's break them down side by side. Method one.
Method one is a separate bank account. The broker-dealer opens a distinct, isolated account at an independent bank. Crucially, the broker-dealer holds these funds acting strictly in the capacity of an agent or trustee.
So they're holding it for the clients.
Right. The title of the account must clearly designate that the funds belong to the investors, not the firm. And method two.
Method two is a written bank escrow agreement. In this scenario, the broker-dealer doesn't act as the trustee at all. Instead, they hire an unaffiliated bank to act as the independent escrow agent.
So they outsource the holding.
Basically, yeah. Ingrid's money flows into the bank's escrow account, and the bank physically holds the funds and is responsible for transmitting them.
Let's look at the why behind these two methods. It's all about legal insulation, isn't it?
Exactly. In both methods, the money is legally firewalled. It is held exclusively for the benefit of the beneficial owners, meaning Ingrid and the other investors, until the contingency occurs.
Let's trace the flow. If Sam successfully raises the full $50 million, the contingency is met. Right. And then the escrow agent, or the trustee, releases the dam, and the money is promptly transmitted to Sam, the sponsor, to buy the building.
But what if it fails? Sam spends 6 months pitching the deal, but he only raises $10 million. The deadline hits. The deal is completely dead.
Then the dam routes the water back to the source. Because the money was legally insulated in that separate account, or escrow, it is entirely intact. It is promptly returned directly to Ingrid and the other investors, in full.
The issuer never gets to touch a dime of it.
Never.
That makes perfect sense. It's a structural safety net. So to recap the contingent paths for the exam, separate bank account with the broker-dealer as trustee, or a written bank escrow agreement with an independent bank.
Both end the same way. Money goes to the issuer if successful, back to the investor if it fails.
Now we keep throwing around this word closing. We say the deal settles or the deal closes. When I bought my house, the closing was like a 3-hour meeting with a notary where I developed hand cramps from signing my name 50 times.
I remember that feeling well.
Right. But in the context of a private placement, what is the exact legal definition of the closing?
The closing is not a meeting. It is a very specific pinpoint moment in time.
Right.
Legally, the closing is the exact moment the two things align perfectly.
What are the two things?
First, the subscription has been fully accepted by the issuer. And second, the funds are transmitted or released under the exact terms of the offering documents.
So it requires both the paperwork approval and the final movement of the money to synchronize.
Yes, that synchronization is what officially completes the transaction.
Acceptance plus money movement equals closing. Got it. All right, listeners, take a deep breath, roll your shoulders back, pause the audio for 3 seconds if you need to.
Drink some water.
Seriously. Okay, we're back in it. We are now entering the densest part of the regulatory jungle. We are talking about transaction confirmations.
The receipts.
The SEC and FedNRI love their disclosures. They basically believe that transparency is the ultimate cure for market manipulation, and the confirmation receipt is the ultimate disclosure document.
It is the final report card of the trade.
We are going to break this down piece by piece so the logic actually sticks in your brain.
Let's start with the baseline rules regarding timing. When does Riley's firm actually have to send this physical or digital confirmation to Ingrid?
When does she get her receipt?
The rule dictates that a written confirmation must be sent or given to the customer at or before the completion of the transaction.
At or before completion. Not a week later. Not at the end of the month bundled with her statement. At or before.
Correct. But here is where the friction comes in. Have you ever looked at a trade confirmation from your broker?
Yeah, it's usually like a small slip of paper or just a single PDF page.
Exactly. They can't fit the entire regulatory history of the trade on it, so they use a shorthand. The confirmation will often have a small asterisk that says, Additional information regarding this transaction is available upon request.
Right, they give you the top line numbers and hide the rest behind a request wall. So let's say Ingrid sees that asterisk. She is meticulous. She calls up Riley and says, I am requesting all the additional information regarding my trade. How fast does Riley's firm have to scramble to answer her?
The SEC confirmation rule anticipates this exact scenario and sets hard deadlines to ensure brokers can't just stall forever. Normally, for a recent trade, the firm has exactly 5 business days from the moment they receive her request to compile and provide that information.
Okay, 5 business days. But what if Ingrid isn't so prompt? What if she is doing her taxes in April? She is digging through a shoebox of receipts, finds an old confirmation from a trade she did back in October, and asks for the additional information on that trade from half a year ago.
The regulators actually recognize the physical reality of record retrieval. If the request concerns a transaction that was affected more than 30 days before the request arrived, the firm gets a bit more breathing room to dig through their archives.
They get more time?
Yes. They have 15 business days to answer.
5 days for recent trades. 15 days for trades older than 30 days. Write that down, commit it to memory. It is highly testable.
Absolutely.
Now, let's talk about the actual ink on the page. If I go to a grocery store, my receipt shows the item, the price, the tax, and the total. What is the mandatory base content that every single financial confirmation must show? I want to see if I can guess them based on logic.
Go for it. Let's see how close you get to the regulatory mandate.
First, I obviously need to know what I bought and when. So the identity of the security, the price I paid, the quantity of shares, and the date and time of the trade.
Spot on. That's categorized as transaction identity.
Nice.
The only caveat is that for the exact time of the transaction, they can either print the exact time or include a statement saying the time will be furnished upon request. What else?
I'd want to know whose team the broker is playing for. Are they working for me or are they selling me something out of their own back room?
Exactly right. That is called capacity. The confirmation must explicitly state if Riley's firm was acting as an agent for Ingrid, an agent for some other person, an agent for both Ingrid and the other person, which is a cross trade, or if they were acting as a principal for the firm's own account.
Right. If they're acting as a principal, they are essentially the car dealership selling me a car off their own lot. If they are an agent, they are just a broker helping me find a car from a third-party seller.
Perfect analogy. Third on the list. Contraparty identity.
Who was on the other side?
Exactly. If the firm acted as an agent, who exactly was on the other side of the trade selling the shares to Ingrid? They have to provide the name of the person, or more commonly, state that the name will be provided upon request.
Okay, what's next?
Fourth, they must state their SIPC membership status. Specifically, they must include a statement if the firm is not a member of the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, because that materially affects the safety of the client's assets in a bankruptcy scenario.
Okay, and fifth, this is the one everyone always cares about the most.
Yeah.
Show me the money. Who got paid what?
Remuneration. If the firm acted as principal, are they a market maker in that security? If they acted as an agent, what was the exact commission or fee Ingrid paid them? And crucially, did the firm receive any other remuneration from third parties in connection with this trade?
Okay, stop right there. My mind immediately goes to the biggest buzzword in modern retail finance, payment for order flow, or PFOF.
Ah, PFOF.
We all saw the news with Robinhood and the meme stock craze. Brokers were making billions by routing retail trades to massive high-frequency trading firms. Since Riley's firm is acting as the middleman here, are they cashing in on payment for order flow for Ingrid's private placement, and do they have to disclose it on the receipt?
This is a fantastic area for the exam to try and trip you up because payment for order flow is so prevalent in the news right now.
It's everywhere.
But you have to understand the specific scope of the rule. The payment for order flow disclosure rule only applies to transactions in national market system or NMS stocks or securities quoted on a qualifying interdealer quotation system.
Let's translate that. NMS stocks.
Right.
You mean publicly traded stuff on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ?
Precisely. High volume, highly liquid, publicly quoted securities. A privately placed security, by its very definition, is not an NMS stock.
Right, it's private.
It is not trading on a lit exchange. It is not interdealer quoted. It is an illiquid, bespoke, off-the-grid contract. Therefore, privately placed securities will essentially never trigger the payment for order flow disclosure requirements because the mechanism of order flow routing just doesn't exist for them.
Boom. Exam track dodged.
Yeah.
If you see payment for order flow on a private placement question, cross it out.
Cross it right out.
Now let's get into the weird anomalies of the rule book. I love anomalies because they stick out like a sore thumb, making them incredibly easy to test. Listen closely to this direct question, listener.
This is a good one.
We just established that confirmations constantly use the phrase information available upon request for contraparty identity or remuneration details or the time of the trade. The overarching rules almost always specify that if the client wants that info, they must ask for it in writing.
Correct.
But there is exactly one exception in this entire unit. What is it?
What's fascinating here is a tiny, almost archaic rule called the odd lot differential.
Define odd lot differential for us.
So standard trading on the public markets typically happens in round lots, which are blocks of 100 shares. If you want to buy an unusual non-standard amount, say 37 shares or 112 shares, that is an odd lot.
Because it's not a neat multiple of 100.
Right. Historically, because odd lots were harder for market makers to process and hedge, they would charge a tiny fractional fee, maybe an eighth of a point, to execute the trade. That tiny fee is the odd lot differential.
Okay, so if an odd lot differential is charged, the confirmation has to state that the fee amount is available upon request. Why is this the anomaly?
Because the rule text for the odd lot differential is the only text in the entire confirmation unit that explicitly allows the customer to make an oral request for the information.
An oral request. Let's think about the why here. Why would regulators allow a phone call for this one specific thing, but demand written letters for literally everything else?
It basically comes down to friction and materiality. The contraparty identity or the total remuneration of a massive trade are highly material facts that could involve conflicts of interest.
The regulators want a paper trail if a client is digging into those areas.
Exactly. But an odd lot differential, it's a trivial fee. It might amount to $1.50. Forcing a client to draft, sign, and mail a formal written letter just to find out they were charged $1.50 creates an absurd amount of friction for everyone involved.
So the SEC says just let them call and ask.
Pretty much.
Let me highlight that in neon for everyone studying. The odd lot differential is the only item that allows an oral request. Everything else usually demands a written request. If the exam asks which piece of info a client can request over the phone, zero in on the odd lot differential.
That's the one. Now, if you thought the base confirmation rules were detailed, wait until we look at debt securities.
Well, boy.
The rules we just discussed apply broadly to equities. But if Ingot is buying a privately placed debt instrument like a massive corporate bond issued by Sam the sponsor, the confirmation requirements multiply significantly.
Because debt is infinitely more complex than equity, right? With interest rates and maturity dates.
Exactly.
Let's do a lightning round. I'll give you a specific type of debt security or a specific trading scenario, and I want you to give me the exact unique confirmation requirement that gets triggered. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Let's start with callable debt. Ingrid buys a bond, but Sam has the right to buy it back early.
The confirmation must explicitly state that the debt security may be redeemed in whole or in part before its stated maturity date. Crucially, it must state that such a redemption could materially affect the yield the investor receives and that detailed information is available upon request.
You have to warn them that the ride might end early.
Exactly.
Next scenario. A dollar price trade. Ingrid buys a bond based strictly on a quoted dollar price, say $980 for a $1,000 par value bond.
The confirmation must show that agreed upon dollar price, but it must also show the yield to maturity computed from that dollar price.
You can't just give them the price. You have to show them the actual annualized return that price implies.
Right. However, there is a very specific sub-exception here.
Of course there is. What is it?
If the instrument is a variable rate security where the issuer can extend the maturity, or if it is an asset-backed security, you do not have to show the yield to maturity.
Why not?
Because the underlying variables, like the floating interest rate or unpredictable prepayments, make a fixed yield to maturity impossible to calculate accurately. It would just be a wild guess, and regulators hate wild guesses on official documents.
But note, even if you are excused from showing the yield, you still must show the dollar price.
I always show the price.
Okay, third scenario. Yield traded. Instead of negotiating a dollar price, Ingrid calls Riley and says, I want to buy this bond at a 5% yield.
The confirmation must show that 5% yield, and then it must show the specific dollar price that had to be computed to achieve that yield. And if the trade is based on a yield to call rather than yield to maturity, it needs to detail the call type, the call date, and the call price.
And here comes the worst case scenario rule. What if the bond has multiple call dates and the yield could fluctuate wildly depending on when Sam decides to call it?
The regulators demand pessimism. If the calculated yield to maturity is actually lower than the represented yield to call, the confirmation must show both yields.
It forces the broker to show the client the absolute worst case scenario for their return. They can't just highlight the rosy number.
Precisely. They have to show the ugly truth.
I love that. The worst case scenario rule. Finally, our last debt category, asset-backed securities. Let's say Sam's real estate deal is actually a pool of commercial mortgages.
Asset-backed securities carry prepayment risk. If interest rates drop, the people holding those mortgages will refinance and pay them off early. Therefore, the confirmation must state that the actual yield may vary according to the speed of those prepayments.
And if the client asks for more info?
If the client asks in writing, the firm must provide a highly complex set of data. The estimated yield, the weighted average life of the pool, and the specific prepayment assumptions used to calculate those estimates.
Because the lifespan of the investment is entirely at the mercy of thousands of strangers deciding whether or not to refinance their buildings.
Exactly. It's complicated.
Okay, that was a marathon. We survived the debt lightning round. But we still have two massive confirmation concepts to tackle. First, the settlement date.
Yes.
We talked extensively earlier about how private placements use bespoke settlement dates, not regular T+1 clearing cycles.
Yeah.
So do we still have to print a settlement date on the confirmation?
Only if the security triggers specific equity trade reporting rules. Showing the settlement date on the confirmation is an add-on requirement triggered primarily if the security is a national market system stock or if it is subject to Fannareys over-the-counter equity trade reporting requirements.
I want to flag a major exam track right here. Listen to the word equity in that rule.
Exactly. Equity is the key word. And to make it even more specific for Series 82 candidates, the rule explicitly carves out direct participation programs, or DPPs.
Let's explain what a DPP is so people understand why it's carved out.
A direct participation program is a type of alternative investment, very often sold via private placement. Think of a massive, illiquid real estate syndication or an oil and gas exploratory partnership. They are designed for long-term tax flow and passive income. They do not trade on exchanges. They are highly illiquid.
Right. You don't day trade an oil well.
Exactly. Because they are so illiquid and bespoke, Fannara explicitly exempts them from the OTC equity trade reporting requirements that demand a settlement date disclosure.
Forcing an equity-style settlement date onto a 10-year illiquid partnership makes literally no structural sense.
None at all. If you see a DPP on the exam in the context of settlement date disclosures, know that it is exempt.
Perfect. We are nearing the end of the confirmation jungle. The final boss is the markup disclosure. This is a massive, highly scrutinized regulatory area. Let's set a new, highly specific scenario for Riley and Ingrid.
Okay, lay it on me.
Riley's firm is dealing in corporate debt securities. They trade a corporate bond out of their own firm inventory, so they're acting as a principal on the trade, and they sell it directly to Ingrid. Now, Ingrid is incredibly wealthy, but for the specific regulatory purposes of this rule, she is classified as a non-institutional retail customer.
Got it. Retail customer, principal trade.
And here is the kicker. Let's say Riley's firm acquired that bond earlier that exact same trading day and then flipped it to Ingrid. What do they have to disclose?
When a broker-dealer trades a corporate or agency debt security as a principal with a non-institutional customer, and the firm offsets that trade on the same trading day, the SEC and Fannara confirmation rules come down with the hammer.
What do they have to show?
The confirmation must explicitly show the firm's markup or markdown from the prevailing market price.
In plain English, they have to show Ingrid exactly how much profit they made on the spread. They have to show her their hidden fee.
Exactly. Historically, bond markets were incredibly opaque. Brokers could buy a bond for $900 and sell it to a retail client for $950, and the client would never know they just got gouged for a $50 hidden spread.
Just free money for the broker.
Right. The regulators wanted to shine a massive spotlight on this. So not only does the firm have to show the markup, they have to show it as both a raw dollar amount and as a percentage of the prevailing market price.
But they don't stop there, do they? What is TRACE?
TRACE. It stands for the Trade Reporting and Compliance Engine. It is Fannara's mandatory public bond pricing system. It was built specifically to destroy the opacity of the bond market.
So how does TRACE fit on the receipt?
Because of this disclosure rule, the firm must provide a reference and a physical hyperlink on the confirmation directly to the TRACE data page for that specific bond. This allows Ingrid to click the link and see exactly what every other person in the world is paying for that bond.
Wow. And finally, to ensure absolute precision, The confirmation must show the exact execution time of Ingrid's transaction, down to the exact second.
Down to the second.
That is intense regulatory scrutiny. Dollar amount, percentage amount, trace, hyperlink, execution time to the second. But as with everything in the labyrinth of high finance, there are always exceptions. Wall Street always negotiates a carve-out. How does a firm legally get out of having to disclose their markup to the client?
There are two main exceptions that Series 82 candidates must know. The first is the functionally separate desk exception.
I love the visual of this one. I imagine a massive Wall Street trading floor, and they literally hire masons to build a brick wall right down the middle of the room.
Conceptually, that is exactly what it is. The regulations recognize that massive global investment banks have thousands of traders doing thousands of things simultaneously.
So how do they prove separation?
For this exception to apply, the firm needs two entirely separate principal trading desks. Let's say Desk A handles the customer trade, selling the bond to Ingrid. Desk B, totally independently, handles the firm's own offsetting trade in the wider market.
But just putting them on opposite sides of the room isn't enough, right?
Not even close. The firm must have rigorous, documented, and audited policies and procedures reasonably designed to ensure that Desk B knew absolutely nothing about Desk A's customer transaction.
It requires a true, impenetrable information barrier, often called a Chinese wall in older finance parlance.
Right. So no passing notes under the brick wall, no sharing computer systems, no chatting at the water cooler about Ingrid's massive bond order.
And if the regulators audit the firm and find that the right hand genuinely did not know what the left hand was doing,
then the trades are considered uncoordinated and the firm does not have to disclose the markup.
Okay, what is the second exception?
The second is the fixed price exception. And pay close attention, because this is a major, highly specific exam trap for Series 82 candidates dealing with private placements.
Listen up, folks. Lean in.
Private placements, by their nature, are usually fixed price offerings. The price isn't fluctuating second by second on an exchange. It is set in stone in the private placement memorandum.
Right.
If Riley's firm acquires a privately placed debt security in a fixed price offering and then turns around and sells it to Ingrid at that exact same fixed price, they escape the markup disclosure.
That makes logical sense. If they sell it at the fixed offering price, there is no hidden markup spread to disclose. They're just passing it along at cost and likely getting compensated through a separate underwriting fee.
Exactly. Ah, but here is the trick. Here is where the regulators test you.
Bring it.
What if Riley's firm buys the bond on Tuesday at the fixed price? Riley goes home, goes to sleep, comes back to the office on Wednesday morning, and then sells it to Ingrid at that exact same fixed price.
The exact same price.
Yep. Does he still escape disclosure?
The disclosure duty returns with a vengeance. The exception is highly conditional based on time. It only applies if the security is sold at the fixed price on the same trading day that the firm acquired it.
You got it. If they wait until tomorrow, even if the price hasn't changed a single cent, or if they change the price even slightly, the exemption vanishes.
They must fully disclose the markup, the percentage, the trace hyperlink, and the time down to the second.
Oh, exactly.
I call that the midnight pumpkin clause. The fixed price exception turns into a pumpkin at midnight. It expires the next day. Keep that timeline burned into your brain for the exam.
Same trading day. It's critical.
We have made it through the confirmation jungle. We are in the home stretch. Now for our final act. We are moving away from the transaction itself and looking at the long-term relationship. Let's do a time jump. It's 3 years later.
Okay, 3 years later.
Riley the rep has been hustling. He has built a massive book of business. He is generating millions in commissions. He gets a highly lucrative offer from a rival broker-dealer across town. They offer him a massive signing bonus.
Good for Riley.
Right. He packs up his cardboard box, hands in his resignation, and walks out the door. Now, Ingrid the investor loves Riley. He provides great service. He answers her calls at 2 a.m. He knows her risk tolerance perfectly.
Clients are very loyal to their reps.
They really are. When Riley calls her from his new firm, she immediately says, "I want to move my entire $50 million account to your new broker dealer." She submits the transfer paperwork.
Mm.
But Riley's old firm is absolutely furious.
I'm sure they are.
They are losing their biggest rainmaker and a massive fee-generating client in one fell swoop. They want to block the transfer. They want to trap Ingrid's money at their firm. Can they do it?
The regulatory rule, FINRA Rule 2140, is crystal clear on this. No member firm or associated person may interfere with a customer's request to transfer an account in connection with the change in employment of the customer's registered representative.
Let's debate the why here. If I'm the CEO of the old firm, I am livid. I spent resources training Riley. I paid for his compliance oversight. I provided the brand name and the infrastructure that allowed him to win Ingrid's business in the first place. Why shouldn't the firm be able to fight to keep the assets that they helped cultivate?
It's a fair question from a purely cutthroat business perspective, but it fundamentally misunderstands the philosophical bedrock of regulatory law. This rule does not exist to protect Riley's book of business.
Right.
It certainly does not exist to protect the old firm's assets under management or their quarterly revenue targets. And it doesn't exist to help the new firm's skill clients.
So who does it protect?
This rule exists purely, 100%, to protect Ingrid's right to choose.
The primacy of the investor.
Exactly. Historically, before these rules were strictly enforced, brokerage firms would routinely hold client assets hostage. They would drag their feet, conveniently lose paperwork, or actively refuse to transfer accounts when a broker left, essentially using the client's money as leverage in an employment dispute.
That's so sketchy.
It was terrible.
Right.
So the SEC and FINRA stepped in and said, absolutely not. The customer owns their assets, and they have the absolute unassailable right to decide who manages them and at which institution.
Okay, so the old firm can't just hide the paperwork in a drawer and pretend they didn't get the ACTS transfer request. But what if they get aggressive? What if they don't just drag their feet, but they unleash their massive corporate legal team and file a lawsuit in state court to legally enjoin the transfer?
The rule explicitly anticipates and addresses that aggressive tactic. Seeking a judicial order or a legal decree to bar or restrict the transfer of a customer account is specifically listed in the rule text as a prohibited form of interference.
Wow. So they can't even try to get a judge to stop it? They are completely disarmed?
Completely.
But let me pose a direct question to the listener here. Think about how absolute rules usually have exceptions. Is there any legitimate legal reason the old firm can look at Ingrid's transfer request and say, no, we're halting this?
Yes. But there is essentially only one narrow financially based exception. The old firm can delay or halt the transfer if and only if there is a genuine lien for monies the customer owes or another legally established bona fide claim against the account.
Let's ground that in reality. What does a bona fide claim actually look like in practice?
Let's say that over the past 3 years, Ingrid wasn't just buying private placements, she was also trading equities on margin. When she submits her transfer request to follow Riley, she currently owes the old firm $250,000 in borrowed margin money.
Ah, she is in debt to the house.
Precisely. In that scenario, the old firm has a legally established bona fide ADN on her account for that $250,000. They do not have to let her transfer her assets out the door until that specific debt is settled or collateralized.
They have a right to protect their capital.
They do. But E, and this is the crucial part, it has to be a real legally binding debt. The firm cannot invent a fake administrative pretext just to slow her down.
Like saying they need to audit her account for 6 months?
Exactly. They can't say, oh, we are currently auditing all of her past trades for compliance, so we have to freeze the account. That is a pretext, and it is considered a severe regulatory violation.
It must be about real money actually owed.
Yeah.
But here's another exam trap flag. I want to clarify a point of friction between two different rule sets. We just established that the old firm cannot interfere with her choice to leave. But this anti-interference rule does not override the standard everyday FINRA account transfer rules governed by the ACATS system, the Automated Customer Account Transfer Service.
Right. ACATS has its own rules.
Let me give you a scenario. Ingrid fills out the transfer paperwork to move to Riley's new firm, but she is rushing, and she spells her legal name Ingrid with two D's on the transfer form. However, the old firm's official account records have her registered as Ingrid with one D. What happens?
That is a classic title mismatch. Under standard FINRA account transfer rules, the old firm absolutely can and indeed must pause the transfer.
Because it doesn't match.
Right. They will kick it back and say, hey, the legal names on the receiving document do not match the legal names on the carrying document. We need you to fix this documentation and verify identity before we release $50 million.
And Riley might scream and yell and say, you're interfering with my client's transfer. You're violating Rule 2140.
And Riley would be wrong. That is standard mandatory security procedure to prevent fraud and identity theft.
It's not interference.
Taking exception to a transfer instruction on stated procedural grounds, like a name mismatch, an invalid signature, or an incorrect account number, is not considered interference under the rule. It is just doing your job as a custodian.
Let's cement that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Pausing a transfer to fix a typo or a mismatched social security number is totally fine. It is standard operating procedure. Suing a client or hiding their paperwork to stop them from leaving because you're mad Riley quit is illegal interference.
Exactly. Know the difference, because the exam will definitely present scenarios that blur the line.
All right, take a step back. Look at the journey we just went on. We have covered an incredible amount of ground. We navigated the pre-processing gatekeepers and issuer acceptance. We dug through the internal holy trinity of documents and discovered the order ticket exception.
We debated the retention filing cabinets.
We tracked the bespoke settlement money through contingent escrow accounts. We decoded the massive, complex confirmation receipts and markup disclosures. And we survived the bitter corporate breakup.
It's a lot, but it all connects.
It is time for the rapid-fire recap. I want you, the listener, to actively participate. When I ask the question, try to shout out the answer in your head or out loud if you're alone in your car before our expert here says it. Let's lock in these testable takeaways.
I am ready. Let's hit the high points.
Point one, Ingrid wires the money and signs the subagreement. When can Riley actually process her private placement purchase?
Absolutely no processing until the issuer, Sam the sponsor, formally accepts and countersigns the subscription agreement. The broker-dealer does not control the start line.
Point two, the subscription way exception. What document do we skip and what document is sacred?
You skip the order ticket by substituting the subscription agreement, but it never applies to the blotter. The blotter is the firm's permanent diary, and it is always 100% required.
Point three, retention. How long do we keep that subscription agreement, and why is it not in the written agreements bucket?
It is kept for 3 years, with the first 2 years easily accessible. It does not go in the written agreements bucket because the broker-dealer firm is not a party to the contract. It rides in the order tickets bucket as a substitute.
Point four, settlement and payment of contingent private placements, like an all-or-none deal. Where does the money sit while we wait?
The money does not go to the issuer. It must sit in a separate bank account with the broker acting as trustee or are in a written bank escrow account until the exact moment the contingency is successfully met.
Point five, the oral request anomaly on transaction confirmations.
Odd lot differentials are the only live items on a confirmation where the rule explicitly allows the customer to make an oral request for more information rather than a written request.
Point six, the fixed price exception for disclosing principal markups on debt. What is the midnight pumpkin clause?
A firm escapes disclosing their markup on a fixed price private placement only if they sell it to the customer at that fixed price on the exact same trading day they acquired it. If they wait until tomorrow, they must disclose the spread.
Point seven, the breakup. Can a firm block an account transfer to punish your rep who leaves?
Absolutely not. You cannot interfere with a client's right to choose their firm. The only valid financial excuse to halt a transfer is if the client owes you real money, establishing a bona fide lien on the account.
Beautiful. You guys, replay that recap right before you walk into the testing center.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final broader thought that ties all of these disparate rules together. When you step back and look at this entire unit, from the issuer's ink signature to the strict 3-year retention timelines to the legally insulated escrow accounts to the trace transparency disclosures down to the exact second, think about what it is really teaching you about the architecture of the financial system.
It's all connected.
It is. We have a tendency to think of modern high finance as this fluid, digital, highly abstract thing. We picture numbers on glowing screens moving at the speed of light across transatlantic fiber optic cables. We think of it as frictionless.
But it's not.
No. Everything we discussed today proves the exact opposite. The entire multi-trillion dollar system is fundamentally tethered to the physical reality of human consent and deliberate oversight.
It's actually very grounded.
A signature on a page proving the issuer agrees, a registered manager's blessing on a permanent blotter, a written multi-party agreement locking down an independent escrow account. The illusion of speed is strictly bounded by these exact, deliberate friction points.
Because without friction, things crash.
Exactly. The regulators installed these speed bumps on purpose to prevent fraud, commingling, and abuse. If you understand where the friction is, and more importantly, why the friction exists, you don't just memorize rules for a test, you understand how the market actually works.
That is perfectly said. The friction is the feature, not a bug. When you're listening, you know exactly where the friction points are now. You know exactly where the exam writers are going to try to trick you with false assumptions of speed and automation.
Just remember the characters.
Yes. Keep these characters in your head. Riley's aggressive eagerness, Ingrid's demanding impatience, Sam's ultimate control. If you map the rules to their actions, you have absolutely got this exam in the bag. Keep studying, keep grinding, use the friction to your advantage, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.